It's Wednesday, April 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, U.S. presidential frontrunners score big in New York.
This is all in the context of the collapse of a rather surprisingly successful weeks-long cessation of hostilities.
A setback in Syria following a deadly airstrike. Also ahead, U.S. forces on the way to Iraq. A controversial museum set to open in Washington. Musical magic from Canada. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. U.S. television networks are projecting billionaire real estate magnate Donald Trump and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as the big winners in Tuesday's New York presidential primary. Both won by huge margins over their rivals and should end up with nearly insurmountable leads in their delegate counts. On the Republican side, Trump is projected to win more than 60% of the vote. And that's predicted that he will be the nominee at the July Republican Party convention.
Nobody should take delegates and claim victory unless they get those delegates with voters and voting. And that's what's going to happen. And you watch, because the people aren't going to stand for it. It's a crooked system. It's a system that's rigged. And we're going to go back to the old way. It's called you vote and you win.
For the Democrats, Clinton is projected to beat Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, also by a landslide, with about 60% of that vote. Her win in New York is no surprise, even though Sanders is a native New Yorker. Clinton was a U.S. Senator from New York from 2001 until 2009.
It's humbling that you'd trust me with the awesome responsibilities that await our next president. And to all the people who supported Senator Sanders, I believe there is much more that unites us than divides us.
VOA's Ramon Taylor was speaking with voters all day in New York City and joins us. Ramon, you started in the northern part of the city.
That's right, Jim. I was in Harlem this morning. Registration began around 6 a.m., so very early. There were lines in the rush hour. Voters trying to get in before they go to work. This is a very popular time to vote. And we were speaking with a clerk there who said turnout was incredible there that morning, higher than she'd seen in previous elections. So that already was a very good sign for turnout. And there, especially in the African-American community, they had much more of a favorable view towards Hillary Clinton than Bernie Sanders. But it was fascinating to see that there was support for both and sort of a jovial, friendly rivalry between the two. You know, a lot of the supporters said, yes, we're for Hillary, but we like Bernie Sanders. We have family and friends that support him. So it was interesting to see that dynamic.
You also went south in the city as well to try to speak with some Republicans. How did that go?
That's right. We went down to Midtown East, which is where Donald Trump Jr., Donald Trump's son, was voting this afternoon. And over there you have a much more affluent, I would say, greater proportion, a white community. And over there, just by Trump Towers, we saw some Republicans who admitted to voting for Trump, but once we put a camera up there, they were not willing to speak to the camera. And I think there was a lot more hesitance just on their part. You know, living in a heavily Democratic city, you're pretty skeptical of the media sometimes. So that's kind of the issue that we encountered there. But then again, many, many other supporters for Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton there as well. And they were more excited and open to speak about their candidates, again, in a very liberal New York City.
Bernie Sanders supporters have been extremely vocal in other parts of the country. Did you run into some of that in New York City, where the support for Hillary was so strong?
Yeah, we know Bernie Sanders are everywhere. And in fact, if you were to judge how this election was going to fare just based on the supporters that you see on the streets, I mean, Bernie supporters that were out with signs, you know, in full support, I would say in my experience outnumbered those of Hillary. You know, Hillary supporters, they showed up at the polls, and ultimately that is what mattered. But Hillary Clinton just didn't have the same sort of dynamism in some of her crowds that showed up at the Bernie rallies. You know, 27,000 in Washington Square Park. That number is incredible to see for any candidate. And, you know, in Brooklyn, that's his home ground.
VOA's Ramon Taylor in and about New York City, mixing with the voters there. Ramon, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, going into Tuesday's voting, Clinton had 1,758 delegates to Bernie Sanders' 1,076. 2,383 are needed to secure the Democratic nomination. Donald Trump had 744 delegates, while Texas Senator Ted Cruz had 559, and Ohio Governor John Kasich with 144. A Republican needs 1,237 to be nominated. We turn now to our social media segment, International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio with what's buzzing online. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
Let's begin with the trending hashtags.
Sure, it was hashtag New York primary, but other hashtags like New York values and primary day were also trending. Speaking of New York values, Texas Senator Ted Cruz's comment about it seems to have worked against him. The Washington Post has an article titled, Ted Cruz and the Revenge of New York Values. The Texas senator threw away his chance to be at least moderately competitive in the delegate-heavy state.
Well, what about the other two GOP contenders?
GOP frontrunner Donald Trump wrote, I love you, New York. Do not forget to get out and hashtag vote Trump today. Thank you for all of your incredible support. It is time to make America great again. John Kasich wrote, New York, we are facing some big challenges. We need a president who is ready on day one. On social media, Trump won big over Kasich. His video posted on Facebook received 22,000 reactions midday. Kasich's posted 5 hours earlier received just over 2,000 reactions, so that's a difference of some 20,000 reactions.
That's an awful lot. Well, let's move on to the Democratic contenders. What are they saying?
The first thing I noticed from Hillary Clinton's Twitter page is a profile image. And I have said this before, and I'll say it again. She has a very savvy team of social media campaign staffers. They changed the Twitter image to a picture of her laughing with the letters, Today is a Day NY. She also posted two videos, one specifically targeting New York and another one about her career achievements. Bernie Sanders, for his part, focused on issue-oriented tweets. One of his latest tweets is about the need to stop fracking. He did share one video this afternoon titled, Love Trumps Hate. An interesting diction in the second word, I think. Back to you, Jim.
Well, thank you for the analysis, G, and you may follow her on Twitter at G Abby Lee. I post as well at VOA Stevenson, and our International Edition stream can be found at VOA_IE. Syrian peace talks suffered a major setback on Tuesday after airstrikes killed about 40 people in a crowded vegetable market in rebel-held territory. The Syrian opposition said a truce with the government of President Bashar al-Assad was finished and it would stay away from Geneva-based negotiations indefinitely. International Edition host Michael Lippin spoke with Borzu Deragahi, a Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News, usually based in Istanbul and was in London today, about who might have carried out Tuesday's airstrikes.
It's not clear who has carried out the airstrikes. It's largely believed to be by the Syrian government. This is all in the context of the collapse of a rather surprisingly successful weeks-long cessation of hostilities between the Syrian government and its Russian and Iranian sponsors on one side and the some of the Syrian rebel groups on the other side, most of the mainstream Syrian rebel groups. And this ceasefire, cessation of hostilities, has been deteriorating sort of steadily over the last few weeks as each side has tried, mostly the regime, to sort of gain advantage from the cessation of hostilities. But things really took a turn for the worse today. Airstrikes, likely by the Syrian government, struck a marketplace in the town of Marat al-Noman. This is in Idlib province in the northwest of Syria. And at least 40 people were killed. The scenes were horrific. If you see the videos on social media, just people people holding the broken bodies of their children, blood everywhere, destroyed buildings, destroyed human beings, people screaming, crying, rescue workers struggling to get to the scene. Just a really ugly scene in this town.
So most of the information about the airstrikes on this town of Maarat al-Noyman, is that coming from social media?
It's coming from trusted social media resources that have proven accurate in the past. Sadly, because of the situation in Syria right now, we're not able to get Western correspondents into that part of the country or most of the parts of the country. In recent weeks, I have spoken to a Syrian-American activist who managed to make his way into Maarat al-Noyman. He's a law student in the U.S., and he went there. He went to this town, and he gave me a lot of information over the course of an interview about what's happening there and the sort of political dynamics there. And that's what's sort of interesting about this particular target. The Russians and the Syrians claim that they are targeting the extremists, targeting the Islamic State or ISIS or Daesh, as it's called, and Jabhat al-Nusra, or the Nusra Front. This is the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. But this is one town, Maarat al-Noyman, where the people, the townspeople, the civil society, activists, organizations, even women and others have been actively fighting against the influence of the extremists. This is very much documented, especially Jabhat al-Nusra, which has sought to establish a stronghold over this particular city. So it's, perhaps very, very depressing, definitely, but perhaps very telling that the Syrian regime chose, of all places, to strike at the one town where ordinary, moderate U.S. and other country-backed civil society forces are fighting against the extremists.
Okay, well, we'll have to see if and when the Syrian government does say something about this incident. Thank you very much to Borzu Daragahi, Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News, for speaking to VOA's International Edition.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This is VOA's International Edition. The United States is boosting its military presence by about 200 additional troops in Iraq as security forces battle to retake the northern city of Mosul, controlled for the past 2 years by Islamic State fighters. The announcement came in a statement in Baghdad Monday by Defense Secretary Ashton Carter.
We are going to place additional advisors with the Iraqi security forces now down to brigade and battalion headquarters. We're going to make available attack helicopters in support of the ISF's ongoing efforts to envelop and then retake Mosul. We're going to provide financial assistance to the Peshmerga to bolster what has been, namely the Peshmerga, one of the most effective fighting forces against ISIL.
The announcement boosts the U.S. military presence in Iraq to above 4,000. That's the highest number since U.S. forces left the country in 2011. On the CBS television network Monday, President Obama said it reflects the growing ability of Iraqi forces to confront the IS group.
As we see the Iraqis willing to fight and gaining ground, let's make sure that we're providing them more support. We're not doing the fighting ourselves, but when we provide training, when we provide special forces who are backing them up, when we are gaining intelligence working with the coalitions that we have. What we've seen is that we can continually tighten the noose. My expectation is that by the end of the year, we will have created the conditions whereby Mosul will eventually fall.
Regional analyst Peter Bechtold of Oregon State University, a former State Department official, tells VOA's Victor Beatty that he's uneasy about this buildup.
I'm old enough to remember Vietnam. I'm old enough to remember previous policies around the world where you start small and you say we have to back up the Iraqi armed forces in this case. And so the question is, why has the Iraqi armed forces not become stronger in the last decade? What difference are 200 American special forces advisors going to make?
Islamic State has been in control of Mosul, the northern city, for about 2 years. Yes. They've got to be entrenched. It's going to be a very difficult battle.
Yes, indeed. And not only that, you might have seen the report in the Washington Post, which was an analysis of a very comprehensive survey of what the various people want, including the ones in Mosul, and they said they don't want to be liberated. It's not that they like the Islamic State. They don't like them, but they don't want to be liberated by either the Iraqi army or by the Peshmerga Kurdish fighters.
The fall of Mosul, would that spell the end of Islamic State in Iraq?
I'm not sure. You know, the Islamic State in Iraq is not so much a physical event as it is a combination of two things. On the one hand, you have the very disaffected Sunni Arabs, and they are the backbone of what became the Islamic State in Iraq, which then renamed itself Islamic State when similar groups in Syria joined them. The other side of the Islamic State is the notion by outsiders, many of them from Central Asia and from other faraway places, from Tunisia, North Africa, and so on, who are there because they believe in a concept, in an idea, that the failed state system of the past half century should be replaced by something more similar to what existed in the Ottoman Empire, that is to say, a caliphate where you have a ruling authority that lives by Sharia law. If ISIS is a threat, first and foremost a threat to the neighboring states, Syria, the Alawis, and in Iraq by the Shia, and beyond that, they are a threat to Jordan and Saudi Arabia. And they are not the ones who are fighting. And yet our government seems to think they are a threat.
White House spokesman Josh Earnest on Monday said U.S. strategy remains that the fight has to be led by local forces with the support and assistance of the United States and coalition partners. A new and controversial museum is being built in Washington by private investors. It's called the Museum of the Bible, and it's scheduled to open next year. Newsweek national politics correspondent Nina Burleigh has been digging into the details and joins us.
I got interested in this subject some years ago when I wrote a book called Unholy Business about the seamy/saintly trade in biblical archaeology that goes on in Jerusalem, and how there are collectors out there who collect archaeology that proves the Bible true in their minds. And I was planning to write an article about that for Easter time. And then I found out about the Hobby Lobby Green family, evangelical billionaires, plan to build a Museum of the Bible a few blocks away from the U.S. Capitol building. The Hobby Lobby family, you will remember, have been actively pushing the line between church and state in many ways, and they have the money to do it. I call them the Koch brothers of evangelical Christianity. They're billionaires. And a few years ago, they went into the biblical antiquities market. They sent some emissaries there who announced to the world that they had something between tens and hundreds of millions of dollars to spend on what was planned to be the biggest biblical archaeology collection in the world. And, of course, when you come into a market like the market in biblical antiquities, which is filled with shady characters, forgers, and people who are really looting things out of the ground in the Middle East, of course, when you come into that market and say, announce that you have that much money to spend, the dealers and the diggers get to work. And within 4 years, the Green family had amassed a what they're calling the largest biblical collection in the world. And the collection is partly manuscripts, that aren't coming out of the Middle East, that have, you know, come from Europe and other parts of the world that have to do with the Bible. But it's also partly antiquities that they've purchased on the private market. And the antiquities, because the market is so sketchy, it turns out that some of the stuff is ill-gotten.
Well, obviously, money is no object in this, and it seems to be more of a very elaborate message that is being presented.
Yes. The point that Steve Green and the donors and the other people who are behind this are really committed to pushing the line between church and state, pushing the line back. And this museum is one aspect of a larger effort to put the Bible, to put Christianity and evangelical Christianity, Protestant evangelical Christianity, really closer to the center of the U.S. government.
It will be interesting to follow this as the museum nears its completion and actually opens. And
yes, it will.
The real reaction begins to emerge from the archaeologists and the experts and the people who've been in this field for a long time.
I don't think it's going to be turned back. I don't think that the archaeologists and the scholars will prevail. I think that this is a concerted effort by people with a, you know, very clear agenda, and they're influencing, you know, an aspect of our culture that they're expanding into it.
Nina Burleigh is national politics correspondent for Newsweek, and she has the cover story in the latest issue, Jesus Goes to Washington. Nina, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Take care, Jim.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Canadian pop reggae group Magic will have a new CD coming out July 1st called Primary Colors. It's the band's second CD after their first effort, Don't Kill the Magic, peaked at number 6 on the Billboard album charts. International Edition's David Byrd reports the group is hoping Primary Colors will keep fans bouncing along.
Their first CD vaulted Magic to stardom with its smash hit, Rude. The record spent 6 weeks at number one on the Billboard Hot 100. It sold 3.3 million downloads and had 313 million on-demand streams, according to Nielsen Music. That's a tough act to follow. But band leader Nasri Atwe says that he hopes Primary Colors doesn't fall under the sophomore curse, where a second album doesn't do as well as the first.
Do you know what? Like, I kind of, at first, when people asked me the question, I was like, no, I feel no pressure. I'm a rock. But, you know, I got this personality trait from my mother, which is like the worry bone, you know? I'm kind of a worrier. And, yeah, of course I worried about it, you know? And I worry about it because I don't want to stop.
Atwe and his writing partner, Adam Messinger, had success writing for other acts like Justin Bieber and Shakira. He formed Magic 4 years ago with guitarist Mark Pelizer, bassist Ben Spivak, and drummer Alex Tanis. Though the group has experimented with other genres, their infectious reggae sound is what brought them to stardom. Atwe says that's a reflection of his love for the island-flavored music.
I'm pretty impatient, you know, with sticking to one thing, but reggae is just attached to me. I can't seem to get bored of it yet. So definitely the reggae is a big part of this album again. And then there's this other side of it. There's this kind of little 80s vibe to some of the songs, too. That's a lot of fun. There's a song called Gloria. That's about this, like, cheating girl named Gloria. Fictional story. A lot of fun. You know, I call it Magic Meets ABBA.
I'm trying to lay you down easy.
Check me out, girl. I'm at the magic floor. Check my word.
Now I know you don't.
For Primary Colors, Atwe integrated the sounds of rapper Sean Paul. The first single, Lay You Down Easy, debuted at number one on the Billboard Reggae Digital Songs chart. Its official music video is closing in on 1.5 million global views on YouTube. The 35-year-old Atwe says that for Primary Colors, the band didn't want to rest on its previous success with Rude.
It was like everything. It was like having, even with relationships, you know, like, hey, we should start over right from scratch, Primary Colors, and mix again. Or even creatively, like going back to basics, just writing a pop song instead of like overthinking it. Let's mix the basics. And it just was kind of like the through line. And it sounds cool, you know, to me.
Nasri Atwe says Primary Colors also features what he calls urban folk and a tune he describes as reggae Coldplay. Primary Colors is set for release July 1st. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition, and you can always find us at our website, voanews.com, and on Twitter, at @VOA_IE. For Director Tracy Carter and Engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking at a seminar in Botswana's Ganzi district in early April, U.S. Ambassador to Botswana Earl Miller called Botswana a laudable example for other countries to follow. Now, Botswana could be among the first countries to actually control the HIV epidemic. The seminar was organized by an interagency team from the U.S. government in partnership with the District Multisectoral AIDS Committee. The U.S. also partnered with the Media Institute of Southern Africa. This program was sponsored by the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, which is the country's global health initiative to assist countries in responding effectively and sustainably to the HIV epidemic. Over the last decade, PEPFAR has committed more than $780 million to Botswana in its response to HIV. Together with the government of Botswana, civil society, and other development partners, we have come a long way, Ambassador Miller noted. Ambassador Miller lauded Botswana's progress toward meeting UNAIDS Global 90-90-90 targets, referring to the HIV testing, treatment, and viral suppression targets. 90% of those infected with HIV should be aware of their status, 90% of those aware of their status should have received treatment, and for 90% of those being treated, the drugs will have had the intended effect of suppressing the patient's viral load. A study sponsored by PEPFAR found that out of the 3,500 individuals from 30 communities who tested HIV positive, 83% of them knew their HIV status. Among people who knew their HIV status, 87% of them had initiated treatment, and 96% of those on the treatment had achieved viral suppression. This was only a relatively small sample size in just 30 communities, but it is encouraging. Ambassador Miller commended the government of Botswana for considering the adoption of the test and treat policy. Moving towards earlier initiation of treatment is strongly supported by a recent international randomized clinical trial, he said. Treatment also acts as prevention by lowering the risk of transmission to uninfected sexual partners. Now is the time to redouble our efforts and together run to and through the finish line.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.